Bonjour, merci d'être avec nous en ce mardi matin. On va avoir une heure, on a la chance d'avoir une heure avec Lev Grossman. Avant de commencer, je vous rappelle simplement que si vous ne parlez pas anglais, il y a des casques qui sont à disposition juste derrière pour avoir la traduction. On salue les traducteurs.
You may require a technological prosthetic to understand my alien tongue.
Voilà, et si jamais vous parlez anglais et que vous voulez avoir la version française, c'est pareil. Mais là, vous n'avez pas compris du tout ce que j'étais en train de vous dire. Donc, comme ça, c'est aussi simple. Simplement, on va peut-être commencer. Donc, Lev Grossman, il est né en 1969. Vous avez sans doute vu la série Les Magiciens qui est en train d'être diffusée en France et sur Sci-Fi. C'est adapté de la trilogie qu'il a rédigée. Mais il y a deux autres romans dont on va parler. Et puis, son premier métier, c'est d'être journaliste. Évidemment, journaliste à écrivain, ça pose plein de questions. Mais avant, et pour commencer, je voudrais revenir peut-être sur votre enfance. Et j'ai lu sur votre site internet que chez vous, on lisait et que c'était un monde un peu de livres. Est-ce que vous pouvez nous donner un petit peu l'ambiance? Comment ça se passait? Quand est-ce que vous avez commencé à dévorer les livres?
This is reminding me vividly of my years of psychoanalysis.
Si vous pouvez vous allonger.
Yes, my parents were both professors of literature. They both taught at universities. My father, to make matters worse, was a poet. So our house was very, it was a house full of books. I frequently encounter writers who describe their upbringing. You know, there was one book in the house. It had no words in it, and if you looked at it, you would be beaten. Our house was not like that. Books were very valued, and reading was very prized. It was understood that reading and writing were, you know, these profoundly important cultural activities. So in retrospect, it's almost boringly overdetermined that I ended up becoming a writer.
Quels étaient, jeune homme, un petit peu les livres qui vous ont particulièrement marqué, frappé, en tout cas qui vous ont donné envie d'en lire plus et peut-être d'écrire?
Well, you know, the first book that I ever, the first novel that I ever sort of bonded with in a profound, serious way was The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. People read that in France, right? The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe?
Narnia?
Yeah, Narnia, right. That was, I can't overstate the importance of that book for me. And it had a family connection. My mother is English, and she grew up in London, and she's old enough that she was in the Blitz in World War II and was transported to the countryside in precisely the same way that the Pevensey children were sent to the countryside. I hasten to add that my mother did not discover a secret magical fairyland in the English countryside. And in fact, apparently behaved so badly with her host family that she was transported back to London in order to be bombed by Hitler, which was considered to be an appropriate punishment for whatever she did. She never told me what it was. So it very much began with me, for me, with Narnia and C.S. Lewis. I think the funny thing, funny for me, not for my parents, was that I continued to read fantasy. Even as I grew up, I think my parents expected me to grow out of fantasy, but it was something that I never did. I became a very serious student of literature when I was in college and even in graduate school, and I still credit Virginia Woolf, in particular Mrs. Dalloway, as, you know, the book that woke me up and said, yes, I need to be a writer. But as it turned out, I ended up writing books that were much more like C.S. Lewis than Virginia Woolf.
Donc une vraie appétence pour ce qu'on appelle la littérature de l'imaginaire, la fantasy, la science-fiction. Le premier livre, il est daté de 1997. Est-ce qu'il y a eu d'autres manuscrits avant, d'autres nouvelles? Comment s'est fait le processus jusqu'à la publication?
I was discussing this with Anne Leckie last night, and we were sharing the joys of having been late bloomers as writers. I spent the first part of my career, I glossed over this 20-year period of failure in my career. I spent the first part of my career as a writer trying to write like Virginia Woolf, or failing that, Jonathan Franzen, maybe, or Zadie Smith. I wanted to be a literary writer, really like my parents. I was trying to kind of prosecute the literary values of my parents, who very much looked down on fantasy and considered it a degraded form of literature. So the book you mentioned, Warp, which came out in 1997, that was the that was the sort of shriveled fruit of my period as a serious writer of literary fiction. It's a book. It was a very short book. It took me 5 years to write. It vanished in about 5 seconds after it was published. And it was part of this very, very long, slow period in which I was trying to find my voice as a writer. When I wrote Warp, it really hadn't happened yet. It was a very autobiographical novel about a sensitive young man with a lot of feelings that he had that were very important to him, who sat in his room and thought about himself a lot.
Ouais, c'est frappant parce que effectivement c'est le seul roman pour l'instant qui n'est pas traduit en français, et en regardant le résumé c'est exactement ça, on a un héros qui ne sait pas véritablement où il en est, ce qu'il va faire de sa vie et qui rêve à autre chose que la grisaille quotidienne, quoi.
I think it's still waiting translation into English in from whatever language I wrote it in originally. But it's true. It does very much foreshadow a lot of the later themes of my work. The hero is he's obsessed with science fiction, especially Star Trek. He thinks a lot about Star Trek. But it's sort of all on the inside. In his real life, nothing's happening, and he sits around and he drinks and he talks to his friends. There's this weird sort of there's all the stuff going on in his head. And nothing happening in his real life, and it was kind of, for me, sort of waiting for all that stuff that's going on in his head to kind of break out into the real world and start happening. But it hadn't started yet.
Ça s'appelle, pour ceux qui lient en anglais, ça s'appelle Wrap.
That would have been a better title for it. Warp.
Rope.
It was recently reissued by the publisher almost 20 years later, and I think it's doing about as well this time as it did last time.
Est-ce que vous pouvez nous parler du second roman qui s'appelle Codex, le manuscrit oublié, qui là est traduit en français chez Kalman Levy, et où là c'est toujours un petit peu sur cette mythologie littéraire, puisqu'on va à la recherche d'un manuscrit perdu.
Yes, you know, when Warp was published in 1997, it was not a success. In America, anyway, when you have a novel that is a flop, it's very difficult to get your second book published. All the booksellers keep a database on you, and you've got a black mark next to your name. So it took me 6 years to get my next novel published, and it was called Codex, and it was much more... It was very much influenced by Possession by A.S. Byatt. Also, some of the works of Michael Crichton, I seem to remember, were a major influence on it. It was a kind of bibliographical thriller. I had spent some time working at a rare books library at Yale University, and it was about rare manuscripts. And it was also involved... Sorry, the headset is sort of glitching a little bit. There it is. It was about people looking for a lost medieval manuscript. And while they were doing that, they were playing a lot of video games. Which again was an autobiographical element that I mixed into the book, because I too was playing a lot of video games. These two things, the quest for the manuscript and the playing of the video games, become sort of intermingled. I was very interested in video games sort of as a medium, and as a medium that we were witnessing kind of the birth of, this new technologically aided activity that we and mode of representation that had never existed before. And I got very interested in the parallels between the early days of the book and the early days of the video game, both kind of births of different kinds of media, and the early days of the novel, which was considered to be a dangerous and immoral medium, the novel, in some ways, in similar ways to the way people look at video, still look at video games now.
Est-ce que ça fait partie aussi d'une, de quelque part d'une, d'une recherche ou du moins d'une mythologie personnelle pour le livre?
I think there's definitely a theme there, which, you know, I'm looking for a less crude word than escapism, but I think I was very preoccupied with a sense of the emptiness of the world, the difficulty of finding meaning in the world, the sort of chaotic nature of the world. I would read stories, narratives, and they seemed so well organized. All the details seemed wonderfully put in their place. Everything had a meaning that attached very easily to it. And at the end, a resolution was found that was satisfying. Or if it wasn't found, then there was a wonderful sense of melancholy and sadness. And then in real life, it was nothing like that at all. I felt very lost in my life personally, and very much struggling to find a path. One of the earliest and sort of most powerful and influential moments for me was seeing in my literary life, was seeing a production of Waiting for Godot, which I saw, I think it was probably 15. And I had this enormous moment of recognition, like, this guy's telling the truth. Everyone's been lying to me except for that guy, Samuel Beckett. It's never really left me. And you know, some of that sense of emptiness and futility was pushing into my writing even then, and sort of was in contrast to what seemed like a powerfully meaningful world that existed in fiction. And the discontinuity between the two became a real preoccupation for me, and which continued into The Magicians.
On va glisser doucement vers Les Magiciens. Comment est née un petit peu l'idée de cette histoire et de cette trilogie?
You know, as so many good ideas begin, The Magicians started off as the thing that I was going to do because the really important project I was working on, I was completely sick of and bored of. So I was going to do this other thing on the side that was just a joke. But it rapidly became more than a joke. I was thinking a lot about, I started The Magicians when I was 35. I'd been writing for 15 years. And I was increasingly nagged at by the idea, by a sense that what I wanted to say, I hadn't managed to say what I wanted to say in the mode of realist fiction. And I was finding what I needed as a reader in fantasy and science fiction. This was sort of, it's embarrassing to say it now, it was a difficult thing for me to really come to terms with as a writer, because I was so bent on following my parents into this kind of world of literary prestige. And yet I realized that whatever it was I was trying to say wasn't getting onto the page. And I kept thinking about The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe as having been this primal, the primal reading experience and the most sort of immersive and compelling reading experience I could remember. So I began to try to write fantasy. And I tried to bring to it, you know, I'd been reading George R. R. Martin quite a bit And also Neil Gaiman, and in particular, Susanna Clarke, Jonathan Strange, and Mr. Norrell. And I was very aware that something new was happening in fantasy. People were using fantasy to say things that I didn't realize that it could say, and talk about things that I didn't understand that fantasy could talk about. A book like Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell, it's a book about a rivalry between two magicians in the Napoleonic era. But it's also it's a strange book. It's a beautiful book. It's melancholy. It's bittersweet. It's confusing. It's profound. It does all those things that literary fiction is meant to do, and yet it's also a work of stone cold fantasy. And when I realized fantasy could do that, I realized that I could no longer get away from fantasy, and I needed to try writing it myself. And so I took this story, not an original story, the story about the education of a wizard. This was in 2004, at which we had reached peak Harry Potter at that moment. And I'm a big Harry Potter fan. I like it a lot, and I realized there was something very profound in this story for me. And yet also, as much as I tried to get away from it, I realized that I was not a 12-year-old English schoolboy at a school for magic. I was a 35-year-old man with a child who was behind on his taxes. So I wondered if I could retell this story in some way that would kind of get at some of the issues that I was struggling with in my life. And so I really began almost as a thought experiment. I took this story about the education of a young wizard, and I sort of distorted it. I moved it to America. I had the characters talk in the kind of degraded English that we talk in America. Sounds different from the American English. They don't talk like that. I had them use slang. I had them swear constantly. I gave them things that you often see in fantasy, that they had drinking problems, they were depressed, they had sex lives, they took drugs. I also made them readers. I was one of the things that I was missing from Harry Potter was, that was a big part of my life, was Harry Potter never seems to read anything. I always felt that if I had been trapped in a closet for the first 11 years of my life, in the home of my abusive adoptive family, or I guess they're his cousins or whatever, all I would do all day long would be read the Chronicles of Narnia over and over and over again. Harry arrives at Hogwarts, it's like he's never read a fantasy novel or heard of a fantasy novel. I became very curious. I feel like if there was a school for magic, the people who went there would be huge nerds, and they would have all spent their whole lives up to that point reading fantasy novels. And then when they arrived at the School for Magic, all they would do, they would start comparing. Well, they would be expecting their education as wizards to be like what they'd read in fantasy novels. They would imagine that they would now be the hero of a fantasy novel. And when the hero of the magicians, Quentin, arrives at Breakbills, which is the School for Magic, it was a college, by the way. I realized if I wanted the characters to swear as much as they did, and I did want them to swear, I couldn't make them high school students. It was too obscene. So I made them college students. When Quentin arrives at Brankville's, he imagines that his whole life is going to unfold in front of him like a novel. But it doesn't at all. It's very different. It's much more chaotic and confusing and troubling than a novel would be. And so, in a funny way, the books become this kind of education about the difference between reality and fiction. Likewise, and this is one of the major points for me, I wanted to take away some things that you generally find in fantasy novels. I didn't want, for example, there to be any sort of a Dumbledore figure. I didn't want any sort of Gandalf in this book. The wise... older fellow who comes along, and when the magicians get confused, that he says, "It's all right, it's fine, everything's cool. You just go, see the path? It's right there. You go over there, and then you save the world, and it's fine. There's a lot of orcs between here and there. But just kill the orcs, and then everything's going to be all right." I'd never met anybody like that in my whole life. All the older people who'd ever tried to give me advice were as confused and full of crap as I was. I didn't want there to be anybody like this in this book. I wanted the magicians to be lost in the same way that I felt lost. No one was giving me advice or showing me where the path was. There was no path. And likewise, I didn't want there to be any Voldemort in this book, or Sauron, or White Witch. I didn't want there to be anybody in there who sort of was the incarnation of ultimate evil, which is something you see so often in fantasy novels. Voldemort obviously is a very challenging person for Harry. Not a good influence on him. But he has this wonderful way of organizing Harry's world. When Harry gets up in the morning, he knows what he has to do. He has to use his magic to try to defeat Voldemort and save the world. Well, again, I didn't know anybody like Voldemort in my life at all. Everybody sort of seemed like this weird, fuzzy mixture of good and bad. Including myself. And in fact, when I did something, I never knew whether I was doing the right thing or the wrong thing. And even after I did it, I never found out. There was no answers at the back of the book. So the characters in this book, in The Magicians, they get this wonderful education in magic, and they gain all these powers. And then when they go out into the world, it's not at all about using magic to defeat evil. It's just people trying to figure out what on earth magic is for. Why do we have all these powers? And what are we supposed to do with them? And really, it's a very different kind of story. It becomes a very different kind of story from Harry Potter in that way. And then, of course, they find their way into a secret magical world. And the same kind of process of interrogation and sort of reimagination than I do on Harry Potter. I continue and sort of do on the Narnia books.
On le qualifie souvent comme argument de Harry Potter pour adultes. Il y a une vraie volonté d'être réaliste presque, de relier fantaisie et quotidien, en tout cas sur les préoccupations des personnages.
Yes. Yes, this was a phrase that was created by the marketing department of my American publisher, and I've come to embrace it completely. The other sort of part of it really happens almost on the level of language and style. I became very interested in the idea of using literary language, the language of literary realism, to tell this what is usually a sort of young adult fantasy story. I literally sat down and thought, well, how would, if Hemingway were to write a fantasy novel, Hemingway would never have done that because he was too cool and manly. But if he were to write a fantasy novel, how would he describe magic? Imagine Hemingway describing a chair, and then imagine him describing magic. It would sound very different from the way, for example, J.K. Rowling describes magic. There'd be this real sense of you'd be looking at it, and you'd be seeing it, but you'd also be hearing it. You'd think, well, how does the room smell after a spell has been cast? Or, well, if you're casting a spell, how does it feel? If the magic is moving through your fingers and out into the world, do your fingernails get hot? Is it like electricity? Does it make you feel like you're high? I feel like it would engage more of the senses and go deeper. I almost wanted to slow... when you're watching an action movie and the camera's jumping around, it's always cutting away from the fight, so you can't quite see what's happening. I wanted to keep the camera pointed at the magic and see exactly what happens. In a way that I hadn't seen in for example, sort of J.K. Rowling. I really like Harry Potter, by the way. I'm not criticizing. I actually love it. But I wanted more. I wanted to go deeper in and find out, exactly what it would feel like and what people were doing with their hands and how it felt.
Vous n'épargnez pas vos personnages, et notamment votre personnage principal. Est-ce que de temps en temps, sur des romans comme ça, Orson Scott Card dit parfois les grands drames font de grandes histoires. Est-ce que ça permet de créer en tout cas un lien plus fort avec le personnage ?
Well, you know, another part of it was the psychology of the characters. There were aspects of the psychology of magicians. Another sort of very formative moment for me as a writer was reading the works of Alan Moore, Miracle Man, and also Watchmen. Watchmen was, I'm so old that I read Watchmen when it was first published, and we didn't have The Dark Knight and all that stuff. The shock of it is just indescribable. He actually sat down, and you could see that he both loves and hates superhero stories. He hates them so much, and yet he loves them, and he really wanted to stop and say, whoa, what would it actually be like? Who would actually do this? Who would go out, put on tights, and go out at night and beat up muggers? What kind of person would do that? And in return, what would that do to them? And the answer that he found was alcoholics, people with low self-esteem, sociopaths, people who are so powerful that they have no emotions or empathy whatsoever. He truly took seriously this idea of the psychology of the superhero. And in a similar way, I wanted to look at the psychology of the magician. What kind of person would study magic? What would have to be wrong with you that you would have to, that you would want magic so badly that you would be willing to make the sacrifices necessary to gain that kind of power? And again, the answers were people with a lot of mental health challenges. Quentin, the hero, struggles a lot with depression, which I feel is something that I think a lot of people read fantasy to deal with depression. I know that I have. I wanted to have an actual depressed person in the novel. Some people find that frustrating, find Quentin frustrating. The magicians, apart from everything else, it's a coming-of-age story. A lot of people, before they have come of age, are struggling with a lot of stuff, with depression, with other emotional problems. It can make them very annoying. I know this because I have been that person. Quentin is someone who struggles with depression. That's part of his psychology. It was part of, for me, taking seriously the psychology of fantasy. And it's something that he has to work through. And it ends up taking him about 1,000 pages and the entire trilogy to finally come all the way out of it.
Je voudrais qu'on parle un petit peu maintenant du phénomène littéraire. J'ai lu que vous étiez traduit en 25 langues. Comment est-ce que vous appréhendez un petit peu le succès des magiciens ? Et puis vous échapperez pas aux questions sur la série télé.
Right. Yeah, well, we can talk about that. I can tell you what's difficult to handle. Failure is difficult to handle. One of the things about becoming a success in what I'll charitably call the middle of my career, you really remember what it's like to struggle with rejection. And writing day after day, I wrote virtually every day for 20 years before The Magicians was published. I started writing in college. Magicians was published when I was 40. And I can tell you, I struggled a lot more with a conviction that what I was writing was bad, that I was trying to put my soul on the page and it wasn't getting there, or possibly I had no soul, one or the other. The indifference of people to stuff I was writing, I found that difficult. And when The Magicians was published and people actually read it and responded to it, that for me was like becoming a magician. It was as if I had been finally accepted to Hogwarts and sorted into the house of my choice, which would be Ravenclaw. you know, it was I felt so much more confident and happier. The experience, which maybe some of you have had, of sitting down on a sunny Saturday afternoon when your child is asking for your attention and, you know, the birds are singing, and saying, no, I'm not going to deal with any of that. I'm going to sit here and work on this file on my computer, which almost certainly nobody will ever see. Doing that for 5 years, which was how long it took me to write The Magicians, during which time I was working 40, 50 hours a week. I had a full-time job. That was very hard. There's challenges associated with dealing with expectations or attention, but they're nothing compared to the challenges of total rejection.
Comment ça s'est passé pour la série télé? Il y a évidemment des différences avec le livre. Vous avez eu un droit de regard sur l'histoire et comment est-ce que vous la jugez, vous?
It's been a very interesting, complicated experience. I think it is for every writer who's seen their work adapted for the screen. Being a writer, I only discovered after my work began to be adapted for TV, why it was that I had become a novelist in the first place. And it was because I have a control freak. I have extreme issues of control. And I realized that one reason I like novels was that, A, I didn't have to talk to anybody all day long. I could just sit in my room alone. And B, I could control all aspects of this production. I got to write everything everybody said, all the dialogue, but I also got to do the sets and the costumes. I got to describe what everybody looked like. I got to sort of point the camera and decide what everybody was paying attention to. And I have an editor, obviously, whose advice I occasionally take. But, you know, it's mostly a one-person production. Moving into TV, it's very different. Just the clothes people wear. There's five people telling you what the characters should wear. And let alone other people who are writing, telling you what your characters are saying. I found this very difficult to deal with. And in fact, you know, there was moments early on when I threw tantrums. I think that's a fair word to say what it is that I threw. They were tantrums. I really struggled with other people writing for my characters. And it took a while for me to deal with that. But I did eventually. You know, the show is, if I could control every aspect of it, it would be different. But I take a lot of pleasure from watching the show and seeing what the actors do with the characters. I think it's very funny and smart. And some of the writing, you know, they take the characters to places that I never could have gotten them. When I finished writing the Magician's Trilogy, I'd been writing it for 10 years, and I felt as though I had squeezed every drop of story out of this world and out of these characters that could ever be imagined. TV is very different from books. They go through plots. There's 3-4 plots every episode, and then there's, you know, 12-13 episodes in a season. And the things that they think of, the places they think of to sort of push the world and the characters, I find it endlessly fascinating. Sort of on a personal note, it is kind of wonderful. You know, every twice a year they'll fly me out to the set in Vancouver, Canada. They have to fly me business class, which is almost the best part. And I go out there. There's 150 people working on this TV show, and they have got little. It's like a little village, and the whole point is to reenact this story that I thought of when I was alone in my room and no one was paying attention. It's wonderful to have this community that you can be part of. I really like all the people who work on it. And then it's wonderful when they fly you home business class and you can forget about all that and go back into your room and just be by yourself.
Est-ce que c'est encore votre univers ou est-ce que vous avez le sentiment qu'il vous a un petit peu échappé? Quel est votre rapport à ce roman avec cette série qui est arrivée?
Well, the timeline has forked. I don't know how you render that in French. But you know, an alternate universe has been spawned. That is, you know, it's different from the book canon. The stories are very different in the show from in the book. But I've learned to understand that sort of it's its own thing, and I've come to sort of accept it. And you know, Hollywood is very powerful. I don't know why this is the case, but you know, television, it's much louder than literature right now. I don't know why that's the case. If you in America, if you sell 10,000-12,000 copies of your book in a week, you are number one. You are number one on the New York Times bestseller list, and there's nobody above you unless John Grisham happens to publish a book that week, in which case you're out of luck. If you put your show on the air and 1 million people watch it, you are number 127 on TV. It's two orders of magnitude larger. The economies of scale are completely different. I was talking to a very famous writer about this once, whose work had been adapted a lot. And he was saying, completely off the record, he was saying, oh, you know, this one was crap, and I hated this one. You know, and this one was terrible, and I lost control of this one. But it didn't matter. He said, just use Hollywood. They're an enormous amplifier. Just use them to push your book out there, and then let them do whatever it is that they want, because they have so much money, and they'll make your book go places it never could possibly have gone before. That's been my experience. You know, the show started after the third book in the trilogy was already published, and it's given a whole new life to the trilogy, which is it's a wonderful thing.
Sur quoi est-ce que vous travaillez? Vous continuez à écrire dans l'univers des magiciens, ou est-ce que vous arrivez à sortir du succès pour écrire autre chose? Est-ce que ça vous donne envie de continuer à explorer ou de faire autre chose?
I haven't so much withdrawn as collapsed in exhaustion. I felt I'd spent 10 years, you know, beating these characters over the head, making them go places and say things and do things. And I've let all that drop. I've let all that drop for now. I've gone on to something completely new. Should I talk about what I'm working on now?
Yes.
No, please don't. If you insist. My dream after the Magician's Trilogy was done was to write science fiction. I wanted to write a work of space opera, into which I sank probably 6 months and many, many hours. And then I gave up on it because I decided I couldn't figure out what's going to happen to the human race in the future. I thought and thought and thought about it, and I just couldn't figure out what was going to happen next. I don't even know who our next president is going to be. And so I came back to another idea which had haunted me for a long time, which was King Arthur. One of the books I grew up reading was The Once and Future King by T.H. White. And then when I was a little older and ready for the mature themes, I read Marion Zimmer Bradley's Mists of Avalon. I was very haunted by that, and I was very conscious of... When T.H. White wrote about King Arthur, it became about World War II. It became about what was happening in the world at that moment. And then when Marion Zimmer Bradley wrote about King Arthur, it became about feminism and that enormous shift that was happening in the world. And I was so aware of King Arthur as this powerful, almost a kind of a lens for looking at... You look through King Arthur to see what's happening in the world right now. And I thought, I'd always been thinking, what would happen if you retold King Arthur now? I didn't know for the longest time, and I thought maybe everything had been said. And then it occurred to me that if you told King Arthur now, you could tell a story about that begins with King Arthur's death. It begins with where most King Arthur stories end. The king dies, and the center collapses. That strength, that power and the light that has organized the world has vanished. And the world is shattered and darkened and left in shadow. It's almost a post-apocalyptic story. What was it like for the survivors? Almost everyone is dead in the canonical story, but what if a few knights survived? Six or seven knights of the Round Table, and they're sitting alone around the Round Table, and Camelot is in ruins, and the country is falling apart. Britain has lost its cohesion, and it's falling into its individual kind of nation states. Wales is breaking away, Cornwall, Orkney, you know, the Out Isles, which I guess are the Hebrides. What would it be like for them? And what would they do? And you would see them sort of questing into this through this landscape, which has lost King Arthur. Maybe even God has abandoned it. God is virtually absent from the King Arthur story after the quest for the Holy Grail. Has he abandoned Britain completely? And meanwhile, the fairies, who have been kept in the margins by the central power of the Christian court, the fairies are crawling out of the woodwork. Morgan Le Fay is still alive and thriving. And so you have this sort of powerful, sort of all these forces interacting, the various nation states and Christianity and fairy and these surviving knights of the Round Table who are trying to rebuild Camelot and refound it. And they're waiting for a sign from God. Where's the sword in the stone? Is there going to be another sword and another stone? It seemed to me that this reflected something about what the world is like right now. So that's the story I'm working on now, and it's about half done.
C'est une question qu'on pose souvent aux écrivains de science-fiction et fantasy, hein, en disant finalement pourquoi utiliser ces genres pour écrire des romans. Est-ce que c'est pour mieux parler du monde actuel? Là, on sait aussi que c'est votre pot commun culturel, entre guillemets, quelque part. Vous écrivez plutôt de la fantasy parce que ce sont des univers dans lesquels vous vous sentez bien à l'aise en tant qu'écrivain, pour peut-être parler plus simplement de nos sociétés.
I think we're in danger of veering back into psychoanalysis if I truly answer this question. It's a strange thing for me. I find myself reading. I'm very fond of the works of this writer Knausgård, Karl Ove Knausgård, who's a big phenomenon in America. And he writes, you know, in this very minute way, hyper realistic way about the tiny details of his life. And I find a lot of authentic truth and power in that story. And yet also, I find myself drawn to a lot of books which are fantasy novels. Set in a world that doesn't particularly resemble our world and play by its rules. When I express myself, that's how I do it. I find it a fascinating thing. It's a very old idea. There's this funny thing where, you know, in sort of around about the 18th century, realism kind of takes hold, starting in English with Robinson Crusoe, you know, and then Jane Austen and Dickens and writers like that. Realism becomes everything, and fantasy is pushed to the margins, and science fiction. Fantasy becomes fairy tales and children's stories and horror, you know, commercial fiction. But if you move back, further back, and you move into Shakespeare, into Dante, Milton, Spencer, Homer, you know, fantasy is everything. That was the old way of telling stories, not stories that resembled our world, but stories which departed from the rules of our world and moved far beyond that. That was people's way of talking about what was happening to them in real life. And it's paradoxical, but I feel like that old way of telling stories is to some extent returning. The sort of death grip of realism is maybe loosening. And I feel very powerfully connected to that old way of telling stories, which has been labeled as escapism a very foolish word. I wonder whoever came up with it. I feel like fantasy and science fiction right now are this extraordinarily powerful ways of dissecting and looking at what's happening in the world right now. It's almost as if the truth in fantasy and science fiction, people don't want to accept it because it's too powerful, it's too clear. They don't want to look directly at it. And that's what I'm drawn to as a way of getting at what's happening right now.
Avant de passer aux questions du public, j'aime bien qu'on ait un invité surprise. On a votre traducteur, on a Jean-Daniel Breck qui est là. J'aimerais juste, Jean-Daniel, peut-être que tu nous donnes, toi, ta vision des magiciens en tant que traducteur. Tu as collé au texte pendant des mois et des mois et que tu nous en dises un mot. Alors, je ne sais pas s'il y a un micro HF qui traîne.
Ah, super. Voilà.
Voilà, Jean-Daniel Breck.
Merci. Ma vision, c'est un horrible secret, je vais l'avouer en public, je n'ai aucune honte. Je ne déteste pas la fantaisie, mais je ne suis pas un grand amateur de fantaisie.
C'est un coming out. Hein.
Voilà. J'aime bien en lire, mais je ne lis pas que cela, et je n'en lis pas très souvent. Donc, quand on m'a proposé de traduire Les Magiciens, j'ai découvert à la fois plusieurs univers. L'univers de l'école des sorciers, parce que malheureusement je n'avais pas non plus lu Harry Potter, et l'univers de ces jeunes étudiants américains tels que Liv les a décrits. Donc en fait, je suis arrivé un peu avec un regard neuf, et j'ai découvert ces univers et ces livres à mesure que je les traduisais. Donc j'ai vu leur complexité avec un autre regard. J'espère que ça a apporté quelque chose à la traduction.
Et comment toi tu as vu l'histoire? Pour toi, quel est son intérêt, tout du moins ses points forts?
On y croit. Voilà, c'est vraiment ce que j'ai reçu au niveau des tripes. Hein. C'est-à-dire, on y croit, et on y croit à la fois à la magie, aux personnages, à leurs univers. Que ce soit l'école ou l'univers imaginaire dans lequel il se retrouve, ses origines, tous les passages, quand on commence à s'intéresser à Christopher Plover, l'auteur des livres qui servent de substrat. C'est un peu particulier, mais ce qui m'a frappé, c'est un petit détail, dans le deuxième tome, c'est tout le passage qui se passe en France. Tout le passage qui se passe en Provence, vous y êtes allé. Vous avez vécu là-bas, ça se voit. ça se voit. Et tout cet appel à une mythologie française, Renard le Goupil, la Tarasque, etc., c'était totalement inattendu, ça m'a enchanté.
Merci Jean-Daniel. Un petit mot peut-être et sur votre rapport aux traducteurs, aux gens qui traduisent vos romans dans d'autres langues.
My relation to my translators is it's abject gratitude, of course, relationship of trust. It's very difficult. I spoke earlier about that sense of control that all novelists cling to. It's a powerful. One has to extend a great deal of faith to one's translator, especially if, like me, you're an ignorant American who doesn't speak other languages very well. It's a powerful relationship of trust and faith, and also gratitude. It's extremely satisfying to me that my books go places that go off into other languages, places that I'll never go. It's one of the best things about being a writer.
Et un petit mot sur la Provence et le côté français, en tout cas, de certaines mythologies que vous avez utilisées.
I'd spent a summer in Provence, probably 7-8 years ago, so not very not far from Uzès. I One has that strange experience sometimes of going someplace one has never been before, and yet has a sense of arriving home, recognizing that landscape, and thinking, "Oh yes, I know this place. I feel connected to this place." It was a strange experience, but I found myself taking reams and reams of notes just about the landscape, about the stone of the buildings, and the color of the water. And when I came home, I felt a strong need to tell a story that happened there. An awful story in which terrible things happen to people. Yes, a story.
Il nous reste, allez, 5 minutes. Est-ce qu'il y a des questions à poser à Lev Grossman dans la salle ? Allez-y, soyez pas timide. Vous les avez enchantés. Allez, juste une dernière question. Comment s'organisent vos journées d'écrivain ? Comment est-ce que vous travaillez au quotidien là, on faisait de la psychanalyse, là, on est dans votre bureau.
Well, I wrote a great deal of The Magicians on the subway. Like a lot of writers, it's taken me a long time to earn a living off of my writing. And while I was writing The Magicians, all three of The Magicians books, I kept a job 48 hours a week, 50 hours a week. And so I would write on the subway, 45 minutes on the way to work, 45 minutes back. And then, very important thing for a writer, I would write while I was at work and I should have been doing my job. I would hide in my office and work on my fiction instead, and then later lie to my employers and say that I'd been working very hard for them. Now it's easier in a lot of ways. I'm not going to work right now, once I send my children to school, then I'm free to write virtually all day. It's really the happiest time in my working life. This feeling of just being able to let oneself run freely into fiction, and not worry about how I'm going to fit it in around my job every day. The children are still a problem. I've got three children, which is a terrible thing for a writer. I don't recommend it as a professional. It's a professional move, having children. That's really the biggest challenge. I can write really 5-6 hours a day. And I like to go, just at a single stretch. I don't like to break it up. I like to sort of dive in and stay submerged for as long as possible. And then surface at the end of the day and, make dinner for my children.
Un dernier petit mot sur la nouvelle qui est publiée là dans l'anthologie des Utopiales, qui est dans l'univers des magiciens. Est-ce que vous pouvez juste peut-être nous la présenter, nous la décrire?
Yes, this is a story I wrote. I'm very fond of it. I don't tend to write short stories. I've written very few of them in my life that have been published. Maybe 3 or 4, and this I wrote. It was a rough draft of the first chapter of the third book, which I never used. And I have to, I confess, it's not strictly canon. One of the things that problems that the magicians in the trilogy deal with is after they graduate from college and they've got all these magical powers. Tragically. Nobody's trying to destroy the world. And so they have all this power and not very much to do, and they struggle with boredom and keeping themselves motivated. And so what some of them do is organize massive, quite dangerous global war games, which they play against each other. They fight each other for arbitrary goals. They'll just hide a marker somewhere, and then they'll have to fight for it and win it. I feel sure that if magicians were real, if magicians are real, this is probably what they spend a lot of their time doing. And so the story in the anthology is set in the middle of one of those war games. There's somebody, who's very good at it, who's playing it. She's doing very, very well. Towards the end, she gets a glimpse of something real that's That's more than a game.
Merci beaucoup à vous. Merci Jean-Daniel. À noter simplement que vous êtes tout de suite en dédicace. Et puis merci au public d'être présent. Merci.
That's right. Thank you. Thank you.